Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does psychotherapy contribute to U.S. culture? From the earliest days of Freudian analysis, American doctors and their patients were sometimes more receptive than their European counterparts to the idea that therapy could make a difference. Since that time, understanding of the human brain and its potential problems has evolved considerably, and approaches to coping with mental illness, substance abuse, and personal relationships have been continuously refined. While some theories and approaches have been far more successful than others, our ongoing and growing interest in therapy reflects a lot about who we are and how our society has grown and changed over the past century. So it is well worth understanding how therapy has been used in the United States over that time, and my guest today has written just the book. Jonathan Engel is professor of healthcare policy at City University of New York's Baruch College. His new book is called American Therapy: The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What is it that we like about therapy as a society?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I guess it appeals to the narcissist and all of us.
As Freud would say, anyway.
You know what? It is odd because I think if you look around the world, when foreigners come to this country and they talk to Americans, and by the way, people have been saying this for the better part of 200 years, they find Americans oddly and almost uncomfortably open and transparent about their feelings. Americans are weirdly straightforward about their emotions and emotional lives to nearly complete strangers. And we've been this way almost since our founding, and particularly Europeans and East Asians, when they come, they're somewhat mystified about our willingness to speak about deeply personal aspects of our lives to people whom they really don't know very well. And as to why it happens uniquely in America, you know, there's no one reason. But this has always been a highly, highly mobile society. The average American moves or relocates every 4 years. It's by far the greatest mobility of any industrialized country in the world. And that goes all the way back to our founding, with people pushing the frontier and moving out west and starting new towns and, you know, clearing the frontier. And I suspect that we developed a culture from a very early point that made us extremely open and, some would say, almost aggressively forward with each other about presenting ourselves in the barest way, which was not true. You know, if you grew up in Europe or you grew up in Japan where your family had lived in the same town for 600 years, you could afford to be a little bit more reserved, I think, because you had these very, very deep ties to community. But when you were creating a frontier-like town out in Oklahoma in 1860, and you had, you know, 400 new arrivals to a brand new territory, people had to very quickly get to know each other. And I think we developed a culture of emotional openness, which the rest of the world finds somewhat jarring.
That's interesting because, yeah, in other places, everybody knew your business anyway.
That's right.
So you didn't have to
broadcast. But here you're always sort of a stranger. And that's, by the way, that continues to be true. Americans relocate much more than anybody else. We're weirdly optimistic that we can pick up and move to the latest in place, whether it's Seattle or Phoenix, where we don't know anybody, where we have no family ties, where we've never been, and just sort of start a new life. We'll make new friends, and we'll make attachments, and we'll join a church, and we'll start a life, and it'll be great. And only Americans think this way. Other people think that'll be terrible, the idea of picking up and moving someplace you know nobody. And nobody else does this except Americans. Although, that said, the West Europeans are beginning to learn from us. They're beginning to become as dislocated and unanchored as we are.
I think it's also fascinating how therapy words, things like baggage, and, you know, we'll call somebody OCD, or call ourselves OCD sort of in a joking way. We use the word fixation. We use the term anal to describe someone who's overly detail-oriented. These are part of our lexicon, whether or not we've ever been to therapy.
Correct. It's really percolated into the, you know, the common vernacular. And you're right. And some stuff we're not even aware of where it came from. And when we talk about someone carrying baggage with them, just as you said, I mean, that seems to be something from the 1970s or 80s. In fact, that really goes back to about the 40s, where and some of these are very Freudian ideas that go back to the 20s. So this has really entered the common parlance.
Freud is really an interesting figure because so much of what he so clearly believed and passionately espoused has been disproven or fallen out of favor. But his influence remains today on the profession of psychotherapy and also on the culture that's developed around that. So maybe we can start by talking about the evolution of his career. He had this mentor, Dr. Breuer, in the beginning.
Correct. Yeah. Well, first of all, could I back up for 1 second?
Sure.
You said that he remains deeply influential in the profession. I would sort of say yes and no. He's deeply influential within the spectrum of intellectual history. I mean, almost anyone who's been to college has heard about Freud or studied Freud, and certainly many people haven't been to college, right? I think if you talk to professional psychotherapists today, people who have in the last 5 or 10 years trained in a professional counseling program or a psychology program, they would tell you that Freud really is not influential. Nobody on the professional level is reading Freud anymore. Lots of people in English programs are reading Freud, or philosophy programs, or women's studies programs are reading Freud. But no one who's seriously training in kind of a clinical or medical setting is reading Freud in anything but a history class. So although they are true, there's deep historical influences that Freud has on the profession. He's really not influencing the way the profession is being carried on today.
And there are, you write, and we'll get back to the original question in a minute, there are only, a handful of people still providing Freudian analysis, even though up until the 80s that was a huge influence.
Right. It's hard to get the numbers. The American Psychoanalytic Association, which is kind of the umbrella organization in this country for self-identified Orthodox Freudians, has fewer than 1,000 members. But that's very misrepresentative. Of those 1,000 members, probably fewer than 100 are actually earning their living exclusively as a psychoanalyst. That is, seeing only patients coming 4 or 5 days a week for an hour in free association, kind of classic Freudian therapy. Most of them are seeing 1 or 2 analytic patients, but then are filling in the rest of their schedule with therapeutic patients. So, I mean, it's really very, very few people in the country are really earning a living as a psychoanalyst anymore.
Well, in terms of the influence, though, of Freud really believing in sort of talk therapy as opposed to some of the other practices, can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Some of what Freud did really, really continues on unbroken to today. And I would pick up 2 things. One is his notion of the unconscious. I know this seems almost obvious to us, but Freud really came out in 1895 or 1900 and said, there is an area of our brain or our mind. He didn't really say brain, he said mind, because he wasn't quite sure of the relationship of the brain and the mind. But he said, there's an area of our mind that exists, and it's real, and it's unavailable to us, although he didn't quite use those words. That is, there are aspects to our thoughts and our memories and the makeup of our psyche and our ego which we don't really know about. It's not present in our conscious state. And most of us sort of take that as a given these days, that there's repressed or suppressed ideas or forgotten memories. But 100 years ago, this was really a rather new idea, that there were areas of your mind that were not available to you. And Freud's big leap was to call it the unconscious, but also to say, even though we're not aware of it, even though we can't really recall those thoughts, that doesn't mean that they're not bothering us or that they're not affecting us. So that was a huge leap for Freud to say, there are pieces of our mind and our psychic makeup which are having a deep influence in the way we go about our lives that we're really unaware of. And I think almost all therapists outside of strict behavioralists and maybe rather strict cognitive behavioral therapists would continue to accept that. There are pieces to our mind that we really don't know about as a person. So that's one thing. And that continues to affect the way we think of mental health and mental therapy today. But then the other piece had to do, just what you just said, is with talk therapy. Freud felt that these pieces of the mind that were unconscious could be very problematic, that they could cause us a lot of unhappiness and a lot of problems going through life, and that somehow you had to make people aware of that part of the mind. And the first approach he used ultimately was what he abandoned, and that was hypnosis. He found that if you hypnotize people, and there had been kind of hypnotic techniques that went back to Mesmer 150 years before. But you could put people into kind of a twilight sleep or a semi-sleep, and they could recall things that they had not been able to recall before. And Freud thought this was terrific, that this was sort of a way into the mind. The problem was that as soon as you woke them up from this hypnotic state, they couldn't recall having said what they just said. So it was, very interesting from the hypnotist's point of view. You got access to someone's mind, but it wasn't any help from a therapeutic point of view. It didn't seem to help the person feel any better. So he felt somehow you had to bring these unconscious bits of the mind to the surface. And that's where the talk therapy started, this idea that if you let someone lie down in a deeply relaxed state and talk and free associate and just let memories sort of elide into other memories, that over time, little by little, they themselves would begin to unpack these repressed thoughts and these repressed ideas, and that as they consciously unpacked them and brought them to the surface, that you, as the analyst, could help them begin to make sense of that. And then as they were able to kind of connect the dots and make sense, they could repair their broken psyche, their broken soul. And although psychotherapy has come a very long way from strict Freudianism, we haven't really abandoned that. Or I would say most therapists have not abandoned that. That idea that just through talk, that just the mere act of speaking to an objective outsider over a long period of time in a rather protected environment, you can pull together pieces of your mind that have evaded your grasp and that little by little connect it and create a more unified and coherent psyche.
You alluded to this earlier, Jonathan, but very strict Freudian analysis required a great deal of time and even more money. So people who were involved in this were heavily invested in both senses of the word.
Right.
I'm wondering how much, though, that cost and the fact that this was suddenly associated with people who were the elite had to do with the cachet of going to therapy in this country.
You know, there was something to it. I think less than you realize. I mean, it's certainly true that after the Second World War in the 1950s and 60s, the stigma associated with psychotherapy began to drop. But it certainly didn't go away entirely. And where the stigma dropped was really only in a few rather exclusive areas of the country, you know, the coastal cities in California and the Northwest and the Northeast. And I think if you'd really talked to most middle-class Americans and admitted, say, as late as 1973... that you were in psychotherapy, you would have gotten sort of a look askance, sort of, are you crazy? What's wrong with you? Some people might have thought you were crazy. Some people might have thought you were just kind of self-absorbed or narcissistic, if they were going to use that word. Or some people might have thought you were just kind of lazy, like what kind of person just sits around talking about their feelings, just get out and go to work and work this through. So, you know, I would say really only in the last generation has there been a broad national acceptance of the idea that it's a perfectly reasonable part of a vigorous, healthy life to spend part of that life at some point or another in therapy. I think there's more of an understanding that even the healthiest and most successful people go through tough times, whether it's tough times in a marriage or tough times in their own personal development or tough times because they're, a personal failing, and that it's really okay to ask for help during those times. That not only, in fact, I would say in the last 10 years, there's almost been a shift in the zeitgeist to say not only is it okay to ask for help, but in fact it's the responsible thing to ask for help. That just like a responsible adult takes care of their physical health, they go to the doctor and they get a checkup and they get their blood pressure break, and that's part of being a responsible adult, that a responsible adult also seeks out professional help during times of great mental stress. If you had said to someone that you had a child who suicided or a spouse who died in a car crash, but you hadn't been to therapy, someone today might look at you askance and say, you know, what kind of denial are you in? Or, my God, you need to work this through so you can move on with your life and be available to your other children or move on and find a new relationship. But that's really a relatively recent idea, that this is a responsible and almost expected part of an adult life.
Denial, I guess, is one of those other common words in the
lexicon. That's right. You hear it all the time. That's right. I remember when it was on Saturday Night Live, it was Dana Carvey who played this this kind of very smarmy television therapist, and she always talked about Queen of Denial.
a point that you make in the book that's worth repeating here is that in his own practice, Freud was not necessarily as
doctrinaire.
Yeah, as we imagine all of his devotees to have been.
That's right. Freud is a very complex and curious guy, and although I think he was wrong about a lot of things, he really does remain one of the most, one of the most intellectual, unique and creative people in history. I mean, I think he's really up there with Darwin and Einstein in terms of the leaps that he made almost single-handedly. But it's worth remembering that he himself was trained as a physician, an MD neurologist. He came out of a scientific background. He spent the first 10 years of his life really doing classic neurological and physiological research, you know, cutting open dogs' brains and spinal columns and things like that. And so when he came to psychotherapy, he came to it more with an experimental approach. Like, I think I have ideas, but I'm not sure about my ideas. Let me see what they can show me.
It's a trial and error.
Yeah.
Jonathan Engel is my guest. His new book is called American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Engel. He's professor of healthcare policy at the City University of New York's Baruch College. His new book is called American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Jonathan, you were talking about Freud's scientific approach to his work. I guess that passion for science and for proving things did not necessarily extend to dealing with competitors and people who were trying to float similar but separate theories.
Well, so that's, boy, you've done your homework. That's exactly right. He was, on one hand, he was a complex guy. On one hand, he was open to the idea of progress in his own thinking and in ideas and scientific progress. And in fact, if you look, he wrote prolifically. He wrote the complete works of Freud take up 22 volumes, each about an inch and a half to 2 inches wide on your bookshelf. So it really is kind of a remarkable opus. And his thinking did evolve over time from 1895, where he wrote first, into the 1920s as he began to wind down his career. And you really do see he discarded certain ideas or he developed them with a more nuanced approach. So he was willing to admit that he didn't know it all. He was willing to admit that his approach was not particularly effective, that many, many people who came into psychoanalysis did not seem to get better. He hoped that there would be advances in the future that would help physicians or healers heal people better. But you're absolutely right. That was juxtaposed with an extraordinary controlling approach to his own legacy. And one of the reasons why Freud is so significant today is not just because of his writing and his ideas, but because of his organizational skill. He created the International Psychoanalytic Association, the National Psychoanalytic Congress, which spun off a number of local associations in various different countries, in Berlin and Vienna and New York and Toronto. And he really kept a vice grip on the central Congress and the central journals that were published by the Congress. And he had enormous influence over the satellite associations as well. And there were a couple of sort of notable early detractors, almost everyone's heard of Carl Jung, who was originally a follower of Freud and eventually broke with Freud, but other ones were Alfred Adler, who was one that sometimes people talk about. One of the things that's notable is that if you look at these quote-unquote detractors, they weren't detracting so much. I mean, really, they were agreeing with about 97% of Freud was saying. They were just questioning maybe a little bit of Freud's emphasis on one symptom versus another symptom, or maybe trying to tweak the therapeutic approach or the technique a little bit, or suggesting maybe something should be done a little bit differently. But it's not like they were fomenting revolution. They were really just offering sort of a variation on Freud. But even that was intolerable to Freud. He just couldn't broach any sort of dissent. And basically, as soon as someone began to have to express any dissent with his orthodoxy, he kicked him out of the movement. He just couldn't tolerate it. So there's an inconsistency in his legacy. On one hand, he was open to the idea of progress and evolution. On the other hand, he couldn't tolerate someone personally breaking with his perceived wisdom. So it is interesting.
Meanwhile, some of his most devoted protégés, to modern ears, sound thoroughly disturbed. Will you tell us a little bit about Melanie Klein?
Oh, yeah. Right, so some of his, I guess I would say really in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, sort of these decades, where there was a desire for Freudians to kind of out-Freudian each other. That there was almost a religious quality to the Freudians those years. They would study these tomes of the master, a little bit the way, you know, very fervently religious people study the Bible, with an expectation that all wisdom could be found in these writings, and that if you could just interpret Freud correctly or take Freud's ideas to their logical extreme, you would really hit the truth about psychic development, the truth about mental illness, the truth about depression or anxiety. So you wound up with people, as happens in religion too, you wound up with people starting with the original message but then distorting it in a bizarre way. So, for example, one of the things that Freud talked about was infantile and childhood sexuality. He felt that sex was very important, although maybe not as important as we all think it is. But he thought it was certainly important to the psychic makeup and to the way that a young child tries to make sense of the world. He felt that children had a sexual dimension to their personality. He thought often the sexuality was focused on the parent, that is, a boy who's attracted to his mother or a girl who's attracted to her father, whether or not they actually acted on their sexuality or even recognized their sexuality, the sexuality was there. And, this became a very powerful idea. Well, some people, and Melanie Klein is a good example, took this idea to the logical extreme that everything was sexual, that, you know, that there could be nothing beyond sexual, and that if Freud had suggested that maybe by age 2 or 3 or 4 someone began to have sort of some sexual awakening within, she brought it back to 1 year or 8 months or 6 weeks, that, you know, an infant could be a sexual being, an infant who can't even open his eyes yet. Perhaps this could be a sexual infant. So you see some of these sort of uber-Freudians almost, people who are more Freudian than Freud himself, who wrote in absurd ways or in absurd theories where everyone was neurotic, everyone was sexually convoluted. From the earliest possible age, people were descending into the throes of neuroses and needed hours, hundreds of hours of psychoanalysis to begin to straighten them out. She would have literally kids as young as 2 or 3 or 4 coming to her for years of analysis, saying that, you know, but for her intervention, these people were destined to live totally screwed up lives. And you know, when you read their writing today, you're just appalled. I mean, sort of anybody with an ounce of sense in their heads or any sort of sensitivity or anyone with any kind of parenting experience sort of says, she's just got it wrong. I mean, anyone would know she's got it wrong, you know. And yet these people really, they spoke with each other and they created sort of a fervor around their own ideations and their own theories that sort of built on itself.
So then you have World War II, and all of a sudden there's this huge problem, the real problem of soldiers coming home with what we now call PTSD, which was shell shock, but also the problem of determining who was mentally fit for the stresses of combat.
Right. World War II is a fascinating era in U.S. mental health for two reasons. The first was that we had the first real total draft since the Civil War, and even the Civil War wasn't a total draft. So really, in many ways, it was the first total draft in our history. So we combed the country and called up tens of millions of young men and asked them to show up to the draft board. We wound up rejecting many more than we thought we would have for health reasons, and of those rejected, a third of them were rejected for mental health reasons. And that was a stunner. No one would have suspected that there were this many dysfunctional 18-year-olds living in the backwoods and towns of America.
Yeah, it was close to 400,000 that were turned out.
That's right. It was extraordinary. And this was just totally unexpected. And as a result, the Army began to take mental health much, much more seriously. They brought in William Menninger. Many people have heard of the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas. Actually, the Menninger Clinic was, all those files actually went down to Texas, since we're talking here in Texas. So William Menninger, one of the two Menninger brothers, was brought in as the chief psychiatrist of the Army, and he was really a bit of an organizational genius, and he began to develop an entire Army neuropsychiatric unit, and he brought in many, many psychologists and psychiatrists, and they became far more sensitive in a very realistic way to the kinds of mental challenges that were facing America's youth. So in one way, the country left World War II very, very sobered about the general mental health of the population, that there were an awful lot more young men out there, we didn't know about the young women because they weren't drafted, who, although they may look like they were functioning, were really barely functioning. They certainly weren't capable of living life on their own. They weren't capable of taking responsibility. They weren't capable of holding an adult relationship together, of holding a job. And even if we'd sort of known these things anecdotally, everyone knew the kid down the street who couldn't seem to move away from his mother. This was the first time that we had broad national statistics on this. But the other thing that happened during World War II was that an awful lot of people got very, very frightened and panicked during combat. We were pushing, although the U.S. fared much better than most of the European countries in terms of our combat wounded, we only lost 400,000 in that war. Those who were fighting, both in the Pacific and in Europe, were fighting at extraordinary levels. We had people on the front lines for as much as 3 or 4 months at a time without a break. When we were, after we invaded Normandy and as we were pushing through to Berlin and when we were coming up to the Italian peninsula, this was incredibly intense fighting, an enormous amount of combat wounded, casualties. And young men were breaking. They were breaking down mentally. And these were young men who really seemed very, very healthy. All of the indicators were that they were happy, well-adjusted, robust, strong young men. And what we found is you could take even the strongest and healthiest and most robust young man, and if you put him in an intense enough situation long enough, and long enough meant like 3 months, it didn't mean 3 years, but that could break almost anybody, you know, day after day for 90 days or 100 days of seeing bombs blowing up around them and seeing their friends getting killed and blown up and wounded. So that was sobering to realize that even the people with the most stoic mental health were really probably more vulnerable than we had anticipated. But we also learned something else, which is that someone who was suffering from battle fatigue, combat fatigue, they didn't call it post-traumatic stress syndrome back then, but combat fatigue, that if you took them off the front lines very quickly, if you could intervene quickly and aggressively and have them talk to a psychiatrist or to a social worker, that they seem to recover quite quickly. That is, they weren't broken forever. They may have broken down, but they could fairly quickly be repaired. And that was also a new idea, that you could kind of enter and exit from states of mental illness or mental distress, and that particularly given the right intervention, people managed to recover from the mental distress quite quickly. So we finished up the war with several ideas. One was that there were an awful lot of mental basket cases walking around in America, which we hadn't really ever wanted to admit, but it was true.
We continue to believe that to
right.
this day.
That's right. Two was that even very healthy people, when exposed to extraordinary situations, could fall apart. And we'd kind of known that, but we hadn't wanted to admit it. We sort of wanted to think of kind of the strong, stoic American type could handle anything. It turned out that almost anybody, if you threw enough at them, they were going to have a nervous breakdown. And three was that with the right kind of help, almost everybody who had a nervous breakdown could be helped. If they didn't come back 100%, they came back 90%. So all of that, spurred us to do several things after the war. One was to start testing people more at a younger age for mental distress. Two was to start building up our ranks of mental health practitioners. And three was to start distributing those mental health practitioners around the country. And it just made people far more aware of what our problems were and what we needed to do to alleviate those problems.
And those practitioners were not exclusively psychiatrists. Suddenly you had people in different fields sort of getting into the practice of mental health care.
That's right. One thing that became, Menninger really saw this, and I think he was really a very broad-minded man in many ways. He realized that there was no way we could possibly train the number of psychiatrists we needed to do the work that needed to be done. We were only graduating about 1,200 psychiatrists a year during those years from our psychiatric residency programs. After, many of your listeners know, but after you graduate medical school, which is a four-year program in this country, you then have to go for a residency. And if you want to be a psychiatrist, you go for a psychiatric residency, which is 3 or 4 years. So it's a lot of school. It's 4 years of college and 4 years of medical school and then another 4 years of residency. You're not a full-fledged psychiatrist until you're minimum 30 years old. And if you put in 2 years of military service on top of that, now you're 32. So it's long, it's protracted, it's expensive, and it's hard. And there's just a limited number of people with the drive and with the mental facility to be able to undertake that kind of training. So Menninger realized there was no way we could expand the psychiatric training ranks quickly enough to get any meaningful expansion in the psychiatric ranks. So the question was, well, were there other ways of treating people? Were there other sort of professionals out there? And quickly, two of them began to fill the hole. One was PhD psychologists. And the interesting thing is, today, we sort of tend to blur the line between a psychiatrist and psychologist. So, in fact, many people, I think, are unaware of that there's any distinction at all. A psychologist is not a physician. A psychologist is someone who almost always has a doctorate in psychology. But their practice today may look a lot like a psychiatrist. Back then, back in 1945, psychologists were almost all experimental psychologists. That is, they were doctors of the science of studying the human mind, and their techniques were measuring it with tests. So what psychologists were actually quite quantitative, and they were testers. They devised tests, they studied tests, they tallied scores on tests. And the breakthrough after the war was realizing that these same people who were in these psychology doctoral programs, they often had an interest in the human mind, and they were astute, and they were analytical people, and that a number of them might be interested in learning how to treat people. It's a new idea back then. Today it seems obvious, but back then it was a new idea. And the group that really got on this actually was the Veterans Administration. After all, suddenly the VA hospitals were overloaded with discharged veterans who were either still suffering from shell shock, or they had reentered society and they were having a very, very hard time reacclimating to civilian life. And by the way, we know this goes back really to every war, but we certainly saw this in the Civil War, was that there's a certain number of people who function at a fairly high level while they're in combat, but then never seem to be able to make the adjustment back to the kind of pedestrian quality of everyday life, right? You've been out there shooting and blowing things up and throwing mortars and hand grenades, and it's very exciting, and now you have to go back and sell lawnmowers at Sears, and it's very hard for, you know, and come home every day to a family and raise your children and, you know, join the Cub Scouts or whatever. And there's a certain number of people who really can't seem to make that transition. And their marriages fall apart, and they break down their relationships with their old friends. And that's one of the reasons we built all these soldiers and sailors' homes around the country after the Civil War. There was a sense that we needed to house these people. They were veterans, but they couldn't really seem to live in the general society. We'd made them sort of unfit for polite society. So these, I'll quickly wrap this up. many of these people wound up in the veterans' hospitals, these newly expanded veterans' hospitals. The Veterans Administration said, my God, we need to have specialists to treat these people, and there are not enough psychiatrists. What if we start turning to the psychologists? So the VA, with a great deal of really internal leadership and I think foresight, saw that this was a possible way to begin to treat more and more psychotherapists and mental health practitioners to help these suffering men.
And what sort of outlook did these people who had been working in labs and really conducting experiments, what sort of outlook did they bring to the practice of therapy one-on-one?
It's actually very contentious literature out there. I think one of the things they would say is that psychiatrists come out of a medical background, and medicine really for the last 150 years or so has approached health from a disease model. That is, you tend to look at the patient by seeing what's wrong. And in fact, one of the great critiques of Freud was that he was always looking at rather broken people, so that all his entire theory of the human psyche kind of came out of distorted and perverted broken people. Psychologists spent an awful lot of time measuring very normal people, very healthy people. That is, they didn't just look at broken people, they looked at very healthy people. So psychologists, I think came at psychotherapy more from a viewpoint of health, is what is the range of psychic health look like? What sorts of things do people who are psychically healthy do? What kind of interactions do they engage in? What kind of relationships do they conduct? Things like that. So I think the psychologists from a very early point became more socially embedded than the psychiatrists. They were more used to seeing people within the context of social parameters and of their relationships, more kind of a humanistic approach. They were less doctrinaire Freudian. They tended not to get psychoanalytic training. By the way, if you wanted to be an orthodox analyst, after your 4 years of psychiatric residency, you then had to go for another 4, 5, or 6 years of analytic training. So it was just an extraordinary amount of training. The psychologists didn't do that, in part because, frankly, they were kept out of the analytic institutes, but in part because they weren't interested in it. So they came at this, I think, with a more, what someone would say, more of a humanistic approach to mental health and to psychotherapy.
We'll talk about what that led to after this break. Jonathan Engel is here. His new book is called American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly. A part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Engel. He's a professor of healthcare policy, and his new book is called American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. So after the Second World War, we have all of these psychologists getting involved in the process of providing mental health care. Their outlook is much more geared toward what is sort of normal and regular. And then you have the rise of these two sets of ideas, humanism and behaviorism.
Right. So it was really in the 1950s and 1960s that you begin to see a splintering of the old Freudian hegemony. So I suggested right at the beginning of this interview, I said that really no self-respecting, serious psychotherapist or mental health counselor today studies Freud anymore. But I would say that until as late as 1980, I could not have made that statement, that really, certainly in the 50s and 60s and 70s, people were still studying Freud intently. And although many realized that Freud, there were shortcomings to Freud, that Freud hadn't gotten it all right, they really felt that largely Freud had gotten it right. But at the same time, there were several new schools of therapy and of understanding of mental health that were coming about that were really very different from Freud. One was this idea of behaviorism. That is, that if someone was not mentally healthy, that you didn't really need to plumb the depths of their psyche, but rather you simply needed to change their behavior, right? And that if you changed their behavior, that was good enough. So that if someone was constantly getting into abusive relationships, for example, the Freudian would say, well, let's kind of explore the roots of who you are and your personality and your childhood and try to understand why you choose these kinds of relationships. A behaviorist might say, well, we don't really need to understand any of that. We just need to start getting you to make different choices, right? Because if we can get you to change your behavior, then it doesn't really matter what we understand about your childhood, because we've solved the problem. And behaviorists really owed their roots to a man named Watson, who had studied, and really before Watson, to Pavlov. Many of us have heard of Pavlov's dogs, where he rang a dinner bell and found that dogs would learn to salivate when they heard the bell. And behaviorists were very interested in this idea that you could actually change people's responses, in fact, even their emotional responses, by training them to respond differently in different situations. And behaviorists, by the way, had some early successes, particularly with sexual perverts, people who were attracted to all sorts of weird things or would get sexually excited about weird things, and whether it's by applying electric shocks to them or whether by making them get nauseous by feeding them nauseating agents at certain times, they could really change that behavior. And there's all these wonderful stories of, for example, men who like dressing up in women's underwear. Well, fine, so we don't really need to understand why you want to wear women's underwear. We just need you to get you to stop doing it, right? So every time they would start putting on women's underwear, they would give them a shock in their feet or in their genitals or something. And it turns out it works. It turns out if you start hooking electrodes up to people's bodies and shocking them every time they do something that you disapprove of, they will stop doing that. And not only will they stop doing it, but they will cease it into perpetuity, that the memory becomes so stark that they'll really, there's kind of a psychic memory of that shock, and it'll keep going. So behaviorism seemed to work for some people. But then another approach was this idea of humanist psychotherapy. And the man who really founded that was a guy named Carl Rogers in the 1950s, and some people have heard of Carl Rogers. Carl Rogers really looked back to an earlier psychotherapist named Harry Stack Sullivan, who wrote extensively in the 30s. And these were very American ideas. And both Sullivan and Rogers and other humanists who came after Rogers were very interested in the idea of a human being as a social human being. That, again, seems fairly obvious, right? What's not social? But they felt that you couldn't achieve mental health exclusive of the social interactions you had. So first you had to take someone as a full human being. You couldn't just kind of put them in isolation in a therapeutic chamber and talk to them, but you had to find out how they created interactions and relationships with other people, and you had to try to gently get them to behave better, behave in a more helpful manner within the social context in which they lived. It's a very appealing idea. One of the problems with Carl Rogers is that he was actually very vague about what the technique you should use to get there was. One of the results of humanism actually was group therapy, this idea that for many, many people, if you look at their psychic dysfunctionality, it has to do with the way they interact with the world around them, and specifically the people around them. And so therefore, the way you ought to heal them is within a group setting. If one of the things you're having a hard time doing is making productive, healthy adult relationships with those around you, why not stick you in a room with other people who are having similar problems and get you to interact on a higher, more adult plane? And group therapy began to take off in the 1950s. Partially as a result of humanist psychotherapy. It's worth saying that the humanists didn't really jettison Freud entirely. They stuck to a lot of ideas of unconsciousness, of repressed ideas, of infantile or childhood roots to some kinds of neuroses, but they were willing to discard a lot of the worst of Freudian orthodoxy. They were willing to say, fine, we understand that at least some of these problems go back to your childhood, but to fix it, we can't just do it in isolation. To fix it, we need to do it within a social context.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones and speak to Etnan in Coppell. Hi, Etnan.
Hey. My question to Jonathan is, when you compare Freud's psychotherapy model with Carl Jung's therapy model, and they were coordinated at one time. Now, Carl Jung's dynamic approach, individualistic approach with gene therapy, and he did some gene therapy with Freud too. Now, Freud himself was suffering from neuroses of some kind when it comes to the Carl Jung's model of psychotherapy with alchemy and the collective unconsciousness, and it goes back to generations, and it keeps carrying on with the mimi complex, the mimetics of human beings. Now, as compared to, my question is, when Carl Jung and Freud's model, if you compare both these models, which approach is more understandable, more diverse, and more understanding when it comes to modern psychology?
So it's a good question. I think most Americans today, if you looked at Jung would seem far more alien to us, less accessible to us. And let me expand on a couple of things you said. First of all, you're right. One of the things that Jung did that was quite different from Freud was Jung took religion very seriously. He took spirituality seriously. Freud felt that spirituality was really kind of an adolescent coping mechanism, a very primitive idea, and that as people became more psychically healthy, they would move beyond religion. My goodness, have we proven him wrong, right? Americans are getting more religious, not less religious, but there's no evidence that we're getting less psychically healthy today. So Freud may really have missed the boat on religion. It may well be that religion plays a very, very important role in psychic health, independent of other aspects of psychic health. And Jung, I think, saw the importance of religion at a very early age. He had this idea of sort of societal myths, and he felt that the myths played a very important role in any healthy society, that myth-making, spirituality, religiosity, that these were really all symptoms of psychic health, not psychic dysfunctionality. So there was a real difference, too. You brought up the idea of Freud himself being neurotic. Was Freud neurotic? Well, you know, he had his problems. He was a cocaine addict at one point in his life. I would actually say, by most measures, Freud was a remarkably healthy man. By most of the ways in which we would measure psychic health today, functionality, productiveness, ability to maintain a marriage, effectiveness as a father, willingness to engage in civic life, in associations, in political life, he functioned at the highest possible levels. He was enormously hardworking. He was productive in many areas of his life. He was a successful father, a successful husband. He held himself to very, very high standards of conduct. One of the interesting things is people see pictures of him expecting to see some kind of long-haired hippie type. He was just the opposite. He was sort of a model of kind of bourgeois civic uprightness back in late 19th century Vienna. You always see him in a full suit with his hair perfectly combed and a well-trimmed beard. You know, everything is adjusted just so. He had a very, very neat life. So I think by most standards you would say, you know, he may have been a little uptight, he may have been a little anal, but in fact he really functioned at a very, very high level. It was probably Jung who functioned at a more kind of disparate level than he did. Jung has largely not had much of an impact in the United States. He was really much better accepted in Europe, and particularly in Switzerland when he went back there.
Of course, people can have all the things going for him that Freud did and not feel happy with their
lives.
Well,
that is certainly true. But Freud himself thought that happiness was not a particularly good measure of psychic health.
Yeah, he didn't promise that from therapy.
He didn't promise that. He thought that happiness was probably elusive. He actually thought that drive toward happiness was somewhat immature, that one of the things that adults do is they learn that life isn't always so happy, but to get on with it. And in fact, there are, if you look at the humanist psychologists who really wrote much, much later on, and I really like this portion of the book, there were several people in the last 20 or 30 years who've tried to understand, well, what is the essence of psychic health? How do we identify when someone is really a psychically healthy person? And one of the best measures is your ability to do work, actually. That one of the things that we expect psychically healthy people to do is to get out of bed in the morning and get to work. And by the way, interpreting work as very broadly, work doesn't have to mean going to an office. Work can mean whatever work is in your life. But somehow work is pushing the rock up the hill. It's creating value in the world around you, whether your world is your family or your church or your synagogue or your town or your office or your company or whatever, or if you're an author, work is your creative work, whatever it may be. But that ability to get out of bed and to push forward, to add value to the world around you. And in some sense, that might be a measure of psychic health, the desire and the ability to do that insofar as your talents and your life situation allow you to. I think Freud would have agreed with that. Freud felt you had to get out of bed in the morning and go to work. But that didn't necessarily mean you were happy, but maybe happiness wasn't so important.
I'm so sad that we don't have more time than just this hour to get through this, because there's so much great material in the book that we won't get to. But how did things get so weird in the 60s and 70s? You have primal scream therapy, and you have people being birthed again, and all kinds of things that seem really off the mark.
Right. So you asked at the very beginning of the show, you said, why is it Americans are so interested in psychotherapy? And I said, well, the U.S. is a funny country. Going back to our earliest times, and de Tocqueville saw this back in the 1820s, we're people who move around a great deal, and we tend to attenuate communal structures and family structures. It's one of the reasons, by the way, why Americans go to church so much, right? If you're not quite sure who you are and who your friends are and who your family is, and you've just moved 1,000 miles away, one of the quickest ways to put down roots and to connect to people around you is to go to church.
People of like mind.
People of like mind, mm-hmm. People who are adhering to a structure that's greater than themselves, right? Something, there's rules in life. We're not very good with rules in this country, but church gives us rules. In the 1960s, a lot of those rules began to break down. Whatever structures we had, family, marriage, church attendance began to break down. We saw church attendance fall off rapidly in the early 1960s. It was the time when no-fault divorce suddenly came in. We saw a huge rise in divorce in the mid-60s to the mid-70s. So a lot of the underlying structures which really girded U.S. society began to break down. And I think the flowering of these bizarre and eccentric psychotherapies accelerated that, or maybe it was response to that, I should say, as people could no longer feel comfortable with the structures that previous generations of Americans had counted on, they began to turn to psychotherapy to answer their inner emptiness or their inner loneliness. You know, they weren't quite sure who they were anymore, and they weren't sure if they believed in God, and they weren't sure if they believed in all sorts of establishments that had really, whether it was the Masons or the Elks or your church or whatever it may be that it used to kind of structure your life. As these began to break down in this countercultural revolution in spirit, people went to psychotherapists to find themselves. And you really saw a flowering of bizarre and eclectic therapies at the time. Remember, people were very excited about drugs. They were very excited about sexuality. They were very excited about exploring new models of family. And so you had a lot of rather unhinged and somewhat opportunistic psychotherapists who began to explore all sorts of things, recovered memories, primal scream, est, gestalt. Some of these actually were quite constructive. I don't want to suggest that they were all garbage. They weren't. And in fact, I think for any one of these therapies, you could find someone who would endorse its efficacy. You know, it may be to us that primal scream looks bizarre, but I guarantee you could find someone who went through it in 1967 who thought it really helped them. You know, there's always somebody for whom it works. And in fact, one of the things we know about therapy today is that almost all of it works. This is one of the problems with psychotherapy is we know it works. If you interview people all over and people who've been to therapy and ask them, are you happier today or has it helped you improve your psychic or mental health? 2/3 of the people report being improved after 6 months of therapy. That's promising that 2/3 of people who enter therapy improve within 6 months. One of the problems is it absolutely doesn't seem to matter what kind of therapy they go to, whether it's going to see a pastoral counselor, whether it's going to see a social worker, whether it's going to see a cognitive behavioral therapist, whether it's going to see a Freudian. It doesn't seem to matter. And in fact, there was one famous study that was done at Vanderbilt where they took a bunch of depressed or anxious undergraduates, and half of them, they had three groups. They had a control group who didn't get any therapy. They had one group who went to certified professional mental health counselors.
We got about 5 seconds left, Jonathan.
And then one group just simply went to go talk to professors once a week. And the group that went to the professors did just as well as the ones who went to the mental health professionals.
Even without the training.
Right.
Jonathan Engel is professor of healthcare policy at City University of New York's Baruch College. The new book is called American Therapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. Jonathan, such an interesting history. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the time.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.